Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The 2019 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine was awarded to three scientists on Monday. They were given the prize for their groundbreaking discoveries on how cells respond to changes in oxygen. Now, their research dates back to the 1990s, and it was fundamental to how doctors treat cancer, heart attack, and stroke. One Nobel Committee member called their work a, quote, textbook discovery that students will learn in the future as early as age 12. Well, Dr. William Kalin is one of the trio of winners. He's a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And he joins us now. Dr. Kalin, welcome to you and congratulations on your Nobel Prize.
Thank you so much.
It's a real pleasure to have you. And folks, if you have a question for Dr. Kalin about his research, about cancer research, give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Now, Dr. Kalin, if you could, I was just wondering if you could just tell us a little bit more about the fundamentals of the research that has earned you the Nobel Prize this year.
Yes. I suspect most of your listeners are aware that oxygen is essential for life on the planet as we know it, and I think most people are aware that if they don't get enough oxygen, they're not going to survive. But less appreciated is the fact that if you were to get too much oxygen, you also wouldn't be able to survive. Oxygen turns out to be a very reactive molecule, and so it has to be maintained in a fairly narrow window for cells and tissues in our body to do well. So this prize recognizes the work that we did, as well as work done by Greg Semenza and Peter Ratcliffe, that allowed us for the first time to understand the molecular pathway or the molecular circuit, if you will, that allows cells and tissues to sense how much oxygen they're getting and to then respond appropriately. So you can think of it as sort of a molecular rheostat. And so, for example, if you went to the top of Mount Everest and your body suddenly realized it wasn't getting enough oxygen, using the pathway that we've now defined, your body would start making more of a hormone called erythropoietin, which would then allow your body to make more red blood cells, so your blood would become more efficient at capturing and delivering oxygen.
I see. Let's just take a quick call. We've already got callers who want to talk to you, Dr. Kalin. Connor is calling from Dover, New Hampshire. Connor, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I was just hoping, Doctor, you might be able to explain in fairly technical terms, like you might to a class of seniors, exactly how this this sensing and awareness happens.
I'll try my best. So, the analogy I use is all of us have, for make a nice round number, we'll say approximately 20,000 genes. I'm rounding here, and genes in general are blueprints for making proteins. So proteins do the actual work here. Now, amongst these 20,000 genes, there are several hundred that are devoted to making proteins that would allow you to adapt in a low oxygen environment. I mentioned one a second ago called erythropoietin, but there are many others that allow cells and tissues to survive in a low oxygen environment. So think of those 100 or 200 genes as being different instruments in an orchestra, and the conductor for the orchestra turns out to be a protein that scientists refer to as HIF, or HIF for short. And so when cells are not getting enough oxygen, HIF tells the orchestra it's time to start playing, and you start activating these several hundred genes, and you allow cells to adapt to low oxygen. But that still didn't tell us how cells know whether they're getting enough oxygen. And what we found was that when cells are getting enough oxygen, a little chemical flag gets put on HIF. And once that chemical flag has been placed, HIF is destroyed by another protein scientists call VHL for short. And so that turned out to be the key component of the mechanism, that when oxygen is not present, the flag doesn't get put on, and HIF tells the orchestra to play, whereas when oxygen is available, this little chemical flag, which had never been seen before as a signal within cells, gets put on HIF, and HIF gets destroyed by the VHL protein. Uh-huh. And what was very satisfying about this is that part of the flag actually is an oxygen atom. And so it turned out to be a fairly simple and elegant solution to how you would sense oxygen, because the oxygen actually gets incorporated into the flag.
Right. Well, Dr. Kalin, I understand that this insight that you're just describing to us came in part through your decision to study a disease that I had never heard of, von Hippel-Lindau disease?
Yes, most people haven't heard of it, and even many physicians have only encountered it in textbooks as opposed to in the clinic. So this is a disease that affects about 1 in 35,000 people, and it was described in the medical literature about 100 years ago, although in hindsight there were people in the Middle Ages who had this disease. And these are individuals who inherit a defective version of the VHL gene from either mom or dad, and because they have a defective version of the VHL gene, they develop a variety of tumors. And clinicians such as myself knew that these tumors often produced distress signals that we normally associate with low oxygen. And so this was one of the keys that the VHL gene, or if you will, the VHL protein, was really part of this molecular circuit.
So it was sort of observations that you'd made about people who suffer from von Hippel-Lindau disease that made you think, well, this is a fruitful pathway for research.
That's an excellent word, fruitful, because one thing we always talk to young scientists in training about is the importance of picking a good problem and sort of having a nose where there are discoveries to be made. And one very good choice I made many years ago was to work on the VHL gene for precisely this reason.
But you don't know if it's going to be fruitful or not when you start, right? I mean, because the reason why I'm trying to get to is I've read that you said that you believe in the importance of curiosity-driven research.
Yeah.
Now, one would think that that's the very definition of science. It should be. Is it not? Do we not have enough folks in the lab being driven by or being able to do curiosity-driven research?
Well, unfortunately, the pendulum in the last 20 years has swung, I would argue, too far in the direction of linking support for science to the sort of predicted outcomes or the predicted deliverables. And so I think a lot of young scientists today feel pressured to do things that are going to lead to applications in the short term. And I think that's very short-sighted and self-defeating. I think we do have to allow scientists to follow their curiosity and instincts, because that's often where the biggest discoveries lie. Now, in our case, because of the clinical features of patients with VHL disease, we thought there was a pretty good bet we might learn something about oxygen sensing, and we knew that many diseases are linked to abnormalities in oxygen delivery. So we thought there was a reasonable chance that this would ultimately have applications. But your point's well taken. I think that many incredibly important discoveries started out with very curious phenomenon where the outcomes were completely unknowable. I think, for example, of CRISPR-based gene editing, which almost certainly will be recognized, in my view, with a Nobel Prize at some point. And that really came out of classical curiosity-driven research, studying interesting biological phenomenon without any clear idea what the outcome of that work would be in terms of applications.
I mean, I'll take it even further, Dr. Kalin, and say that I believe in science, great discoveries require unknown outcomes. I mean, if the point of the research is to arrive at a known outcome or a particular desired outcome, that by definition is not a discovery.
Oh, I love you. I mean, this is something I talk to my students about all the time. And, you know, I like to contrast doing science versus doing engineering. For example, one of the defining moments of my childhood was putting a man on the moon. But that was largely an engineering problem. It wasn't so much a science problem as an engineering problem. And to your point, I tell my students, you know, engineers live for expected results, but a good scientist should live for unexpected results, because over and over, it's those unexpected results that change the way you think and often lead to the most important discoveries.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Kalin, if I may, I'd like to explore a little bit about the personal meaning of this prize to you as well, because I must mention your late wife, Dr. Carolyn Kalin, who was also a professor at Harvard Medical School as well, and a breast cancer surgeon.
Correct.
Can you tell us what this meant to you to win this prize after her death?
Yes. So I met Carolyn when I was finishing my clinical training in internal medicine at Johns Hopkins, and she was a fourth-year medical student. And as you said, she went on to become a leading breast cancer surgeon in New England, and was beloved by her patients. Ironically, she diagnosed herself with breast cancer in 2003, at a time that she was writing a book to help her patients navigate their way through breast cancer care, and she had no idea it would become so personal. But I think for that reason, the book was very compelling, and helped countless patients. She survived the breast cancer, but then died of a brain tumor unrelated to her breast cancer in 2015. But she was my partner and soulmate in everything I did. And, you know, years ago when we would allow ourselves to be silly, we would dream about, you know, what would happen if I did win the Nobel Prize, and, you know, what sort of dress would she wear, and who would we invite, et cetera. So it was obviously a bit bittersweet to get the phone call at 5 o'clock in the morning from Stockholm. And my first thought was that, you know, I hope she's smiling down. I think she is, because this was partly a testimony to the role she played in my life.
Bittersweet is the word, but also hopeful, because, I mean, your research directly has an impact on the development or understanding of cancer treatments, does it not?
It does. I think that we've been very gratified that some of our work has already led to new treatments for kidney cancer, and we anticipate having hopefully some impact on some other cancers as well. At the same time, there's a new class of drugs that is emerging from this work that's going to be used for the treatment of anemia or low red blood cell counts. And so that illustrates another point, which is, you know, when you do curiosity-driven research, you know, we can't predict the outcomes, but the only thing we can be sure of is the more we invest in generating knowledge, the more we will eventually have those new treatments. So here I'm a cancer biologist and a cancer doctor, and yet I've helped develop a drug that is going to be used by hematologists and internists to treat anemia. But that's really the way real science works. Real science, I think you have to let scientists follow the road and see where it takes them. And just, you know, again, the only thing that you can be sure of is the more knowledge we can generate, the more we'll be able to have improved outcomes in time. But I understand it's both frustrating, but I would also argue exhilarating, that when you're doing science, you don't necessarily know where the road is going to take you.
Mm-hmm. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Dr. Kaelin, if I may, I mean, from my layperson's perspective, part of what really amazes me about your work is that it's basically trying to tackle or actually not tackle, but enrich our understanding of a really basic question, right? I mean, we're talking about fundamentals of human biology or the biology of living cells, as a whole. When we take something, as common or essential for life as oxygen, yes, and just ask, how do cells like look for,
yes,
it?
Yes. Yes. And I think in a way it's very nice that both my fellow awardees and I are physician scientists, because I mentioned earlier, I think scientists are currently under too much pressure to justify what they're doing in terms of application. And that's particularly, I think, true for physician scientists. But, you know, I feel strongly, as do my fellow awardees, that everything starts with generating knowledge, and that often means stepping back and doing the basic mechanistic work, the fundamental work first. And so I've been quoted as saying there are no shortcuts, because I don't think there are any shortcuts. I mean, real translation happens when you know enough to know what you can do. And so you have to do the legwork first to generate enough new knowledge to really move forward with translation.
It seems as if the Nobel Committee in this year and last are really recognizing work in medicine that's had a direct impact on cancer. I'm thinking of Dr. James Allison and Tasuku Honjo, who won last year for their work on cancer therapies. And, I mean, Dr. Kaelin, is there reason to be optimistic about tackling cancer? Are we getting closer to real cures for a whole variety of cancers?
We certainly are. I mean, actually, you know, I entered the field in the late 80s. In hindsight, you know, we at that time, we didn't even have the first draft of the human genome. And so we didn't even have the parts list to really start to work through these various cancers and figure out at the molecular level, you know, what's really gone wrong in these various cancers, you know. And so I think what's happening is quite predictable, that now that we had the parts list with the publication of the human genome, and we've started to understand which genes are altered in which cancers, we're starting to see a new wave of targeted drugs. I'm sure you've spoken a lot about on your program. But I think right now we're in the window where, with a lot of these targeted agents, they're being used as single agents. And we know that's not going to be able to eradicate most cancers. That what we need for most cancers is going to be, you know, a, for example, three-drug combination of drugs, each of which is effective on their own. But we're certainly getting there. And I think the recent breakthroughs with immunotherapy are tremendously exciting. And I think that, coupled with some other advances, leaves me hopeful. But I always, you know, warn people, it's not going to be one fell swoop, as you well know, because at the molecular level, you know, breast cancer is quite distinct than, for example, colon cancer or lung cancer. So we're learning the rules for the different cancers, and, you know, we are making progress. Obviously not fast enough, but it is coming.
Well, Dr. William Kalin is the 2019 Nobel Prize winner in Physiology or Medicine. He shares the award with Peter Ratcliffe at Oxford University and Greg Semenza at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Kalin is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute as well. Dr. Kalin, congratulations once again. Thank you so much. And I definitely hear your call for more curiosity-driven research in labs across America.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.